two people seated together on the pew of a park bench, at the altar of a kitchen table. This is holiness. The necessity to connect, to know that we belong to each other. And how regular is a place like a park bench, a kitchen table, the sacredness of what can go on at these very, very ordinary, everyday places, to know that those moments are really important, really, really important. I love that line, that moment of being heard, two people at the kitchen table. So how can we continue to learn to listen intently and generously, presently, curiosity, let that curiousness come through. And my sense is that when we do that, there are these deep, my own experience is of deep connection and a cultivation of non-harming. Is when we connect with one another from our hearts, the likelihood of causing any harm is really decreased. So I'm thinking about this a lot, certainly in the context of coming up to the election. And as all of us knows, whether you are in this country or you are out of this country somewhere else, that it's a fraught time. There's a lot of stress for everyone in some way or another. I shouldn't say for everyone, but there is a very strong current of tension and stress that is, I think, palpable in many ways. And I recently, last week and the week before, I was in Wisconsin visiting some family. I was there for a nephew's wedding, and I was in a place in Wisconsin that is extremely conservative. And it was a very interesting experience because I felt in some ways completely out of place. And certainly I was with my family and it was on Lake Michigan and it was very beautiful, but there were a lot of very big electronic billboards that said things that don't jive with my values. And so it's an interesting thing to be immersed in a community that is unlike what I am accustomed to, and that really forced me to experience that kind of discomfort and to notice how my different opinions would rise up or my anxiety would rise up or how it wouldn't. But one of the things that I noticed is that there was this one huge billboard, because it was coming up to Halloween, that talked about come to the fear fest. Come to the fear fest. And I thought, that is the last thing in the world I'm going to do, is go to a fear fest. And I started this whole thought process about, what if we didn't intentionally scare each other? What would it be like to not scare each other, to not engage in fear? And I get it that this was about Halloween, but I'm riffing on it from a different perspective, because there's so much fear. Obviously, there's so much fear. And it brought me to that place of my own very deep commitment to not causing harm to myself or anybody else, if at all possible. And I understand, harm is done all the time. I know every time I turn my car on, it causes some harm. But to be able to understand how we can foment fear, how fear works in each one of us, and to not make a difficult thing more difficult. I also have a very strong commitment to not letting ill will take up residence inside of me. And I'm very serious about this, because I know that if I get stuck in my views and opinions, I can make, I can, it's harder on me. And I think you probably know what I'm talking about with this. And so by making this, having this very strong vow of not letting ill will of any kind take up residence is the best way I can put it. I'm freer and I have more capacity to talk with others. And I may have shared this with you last time, but I'm coming back to this very beautiful teaching from the writer Maxine Hong Kingston. She says, "In a time of destruction, create something. In a time of destruction, create something. A poem, a parade, a community, a school, a vow, a moral principle, one peaceful moment." And there are teachings like this that are useful over and over and over again. In fact, you know, all these timeless teachings that we study in the Dharma, they're timeless because they are timeless, because they work, because they're reliable, because they're refuges. So, in that instruction that in a difficult time, do something good, make something, even if it's applesauce, you know, it's apple season. Disengage from that which causes more fear, more anxiety, and go do something that nourishes you. Really, go do something that nourishes you. Find ways to connect. So I was thinking about this Fear Fest thing, and yuck. I mean, you know, it's hard to be so like straightforward about it, but it's not good for the heart. It is not good. And I don't understand. I've never been one to be able to go to horror movies or things that have a lot of suspense because I find it frightening and it gets inside of me and it dysregulates my nervous system and it lasts for a long time. And I can still remember scary movies, like really scary movies that I went to as a kid. And it's not what I can do. So that leads me to, in this difficult, fraught, anxious time, recognizing that everything that is going on now, all the way up until November 4th and 5th, is going to be going on November 6th and 7th and 8th, which is why these practices, another reason why they're so beautiful, because they can hold us through these times. I think it's my experience that they do. So another thing came up recently about this, which is that I was meeting with somebody who wasn't sure what she was going to do about voting. And this was actually one of my students. And we were having this long conversation, and she was talking about, well, this is what I think, and this is what I'm going to do, and this is what I'm not going to do. And, you know, there was just lots of anxiety about all of it. And she really wanted to talk about her views. So that was fine. That was fine with me. And I knew that her views were probably quite different than my views. And so in that moment, what happened is we started to have a conversation about what was important. And so I said to her, "What is important to you? Really, what are the issues that matter to you? What is important to you?" Which led into a really beautiful, heartfelt, connected conversation about what is important and what is meaningful. And views became separate. Does that make sense to you? How views and opinions can become separate and outside of the conversation when the conversation is actually about what is meaningful to you, what is meaningful to me. Because it led to that place that we each have our own paths, but the bottom line is, I think that we care about each other. And that's a beautiful meditation, actually, to be able to maybe in the mind's eye, in the meditation, or even in a conversation, to be able to say, you have your path, I have my path, and I care about you. And we've likely talked about that in here, but I think that this is powerful to be able to get to the heart of caring. And this is something that we can create in a time of destruction, in a time of disruption. We can cultivate more care. I think it's really true, especially if we're intentional about it. And what we don't want to do is sow more dukkha. Right? And over again, the Buddha teaches, find out what will support the well-being of yourself and others and go in that direction. And when you know what doesn't support that, what causes more suffering, stop doing it. And that takes a lot of skill to stop doing it, to undo habits that are harmful. But to actually have a real conversation that says, what is important to you? Because when we talk like that, we learn so much about each other and we cultivate respect and trust and don't need to say, well, that's not important to me. This isn't about me. It's about what is important to you. And it takes some courage and connection to actually just be willing to listen in that way. Because there is almost nothing, I think, better than feeling connected, to know one belongs, to know one is cared for through this practice of listening, listening intently, to know what is meaningful for another person. So that brings me to a discussion from the verses of the faith mind. This is from the third Zen ancestor, Zongzheng. And you may know this, and I want to put this in the chat so you can follow along with me because I want to begin a discussion about this for us. Let's see. Okay, can you see that? All right. Now, because this comes from Zen practice, it may take, you know, sometimes it's a little bit paradoxical and mind twisting in some ways. I just want to read this to you. The great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences. Okay, so right away out the door, how do you feel about that? Right? The great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences. Well, I have preferences. My guess is you have preferences. How do we square that? And the great way, meaning the Dharma practice, this beautiful way of life. For those who have no preferences, meaning that we can meet varying opinions with equal respect. I think this is what it is, with equal respect. When love and hate are both absent, everything becomes clear and undisguised. So you might think, wait a minute, of course I want hate to be absent, but why do I want love to be absent? I don't think that's what it's saying. And this is all up to you. We're going to talk about this, so you may have a different experience of this. But I don't think that what is written here is that says, when don't love. I think this whole practice is about love. But I think we're talking about the polarities, the extremes. When we don't hang out and it's only this way or only that way, then things become more clear and undisguised. And he goes on to write, make the smallest distinction, however, and heaven and earth are set infinitely apart. This is the tender, precious balance, I think. Everything becomes clear and undisguised, but make the smallest distinction, and everything is set infinitely apart. This is how tenuous this balance is. If you wish to see the truth, then hold no opinions for, against anything. So then we can get into a discussion about what is the difference between a view, what is the difference between an opinion, or between the two. But I think that this is the invitation into say what else is true. Many things can be true all at the same time, depending on one's view, depending on one's conditioning, the lenses through which we view our lives. To set up what you like against what you dislike is the disease of the mind. Because we're so busy trying to keep things comfortable for ourselves by, I like this, I don't like this, this is comfortable, this is uncomfortable. And you know all about these worldly winds of praise and blame and gain and loss and pleasure and pain, fame and shame. So every time we have all of these polarities, we can come into this place of not seeing things clearly, that everything exists all together and everything is connected. When the deep meaning of things is not understood, the mind's essential peace is disturbed to no avail. And so this is, you know, we talked, I think, last time about the courage to look deeply when the deep meaning of things is not understood. And this is when Thich Nhat Hanh says, mindfulness allows us to look deeply and see what is going on. And we need all of this deep practice and the clarity of mind to see more and more clearly. This is our practice, and it takes time, and we all know that, and that's why we come back over and over again. I love this next line. And these are excerpted. This goes on and on for pages and pages, but I've pulled out a few lines. Stop talking and thinking, and there is nothing you will not be able to know. Isn't that great? Stop talking and thinking, and there is nothing you will not be able to know. How I relate to that, how I understand it, is that my formal meditation practice allows my mind to quiet and open so wisdom can arise. And what is already deep inside of me has the space to come up, like an air hole forms. So when I stop talking and when I let my mind quiet, the natural wisdom that is inside every single one of us has a space to show itself. Do not search for the truth, only cease to cherish opinions. So we can talk about what that might mean. Many things are true. But I think we're talking about the incessant searching or chasing of that. And when we release our grip on how we think things should be, only cease to cherish opinions, you know, in the Metta Sutta, by not holding to fixed views. The pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, is not born again into this world. So opening, understanding that it can't only be one way or this way, but things are many ways. Again, if you do not discriminate between coarse and fine, you will not be tempted to prejudice and opinion. So over and over again, this instruction is talking about views, opinions, and making it this way or that way. And lastly, to live in this realization is to be without anxiety about non-perfection. Isn't that fantastic? It really is, because I want to be without anxiety about non-perfection. And that is actually something I've noticed in my own practice that has really eased up in my life, is this idea that perfect even exists. I mean, remember that beautiful teaching from Suzuki Roshi? This is your perfect just the way you are, but you could use a little improvement, you know? So letting go of this idea of this, like, I'm right and it's going to be like this and it's perfect and just, and it, in order for me to be happy, it needs to fit in this box. How ridiculous. And how do we judge others? To what standards are we judging ourselves and others? To live in the realization that we don't have to grip onto this way or that way and hold those opinions, that there's freedom when we let go of that, to be without anxiety about non-perfection. So this brings up for me, let me just figure this out. Okay. Can you still see that in your chat? I just closed mine down. You can't see it? Oh, you can see it. Yes? Barbara can't. Okay. Some of you can see it. Some of you. Okay. Barbara, just open your chat and then you should be able to see it. So I think what this is pointing to, like we can hear these teachings about not holding to fixed views. The great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences. But how does it actually work? And this is a really important piece about we can learn these things. We can read verses of the faith mind and take it in and think, oh, that sounds like a really good idea. Like many of the teachings. It's all up here, right? It's conceptual. But how does it work? In everyday walking around. And that's what I want to talk about for a few minutes. Now, you may have done this exercise with me before, and we're going to do it again. There's this really great book that I've only read parts of, and I can't remember who wrote it. It's called Being Wrong. And it's a woman who was studying the physiology and the psychology of rightness and wrongness. And I'm not talking about moral rightness and moral wrongness. I'm talking about the experience of feeling like you know something, or self-righteousness versus wrong, like getting something wrong, being off track, just not getting it. And we have so much cultural conditioning around being right or being wrong and how it affects the nervous system. So I want to ask you to just go inside for a moment and think of a time, or make one up, where you knew you were right, absolutely right. And I don't mean morally right, but you were right. What does it feel like in your body? Is there a physical sensation associated with this experience of righteousness? Anybody willing to say what that's like? You can just go ahead and unmute.
It feels solid.
Solid, yeah.
It feels puffy and solid.
Yeah, right. Who else? Catherine Schultz, thank you, Jan. That's who it is.
It feels tight.
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 Yeah, tight.
Unless I know I'm really right.
This is great. Who else? What is it like? Is there a physical sensation with right and righteousness?
Anger sometimes.
Yeah.
Anger.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you feel that in the body, Barbara?
Oh, yeah. Along with that solidity.
Yeah. Anybody else? I feel a stiffness. I feel a rigidity when that happens to me. Okay, now let's do the opposite. Go inside and perhaps bring about a time, or imagine the experience of being wrong. Not wronged, but not getting something, not understanding and making a mistake, being wrong. In any sensation around that, see if you can let that be known. And what does that feel like? Anybody? Nancy, it looks like you're unmuted.
Well, I was just trying to find a way to talk about it.
Yeah.
I don't know what the sensation is. I feel less than, I feel stupid.
Uh-huh. Yeah. 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 Less than, stupid.
Embarrassed.
Linda, please.
embarrassed.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah.
It shouldn't be. Shouldn't. Yeah.
Yeah. Deborah.
I think I've made some progress here. I actually get a release in my body and I think, oh, I've just screwed that up. And I want to go back and either put the ingredients in the pot differently or call my friend back and say, I just screwed up, shouldn't have said that. So, yeah, thank you for that.
Yeah. So isn't this, Barbara, were you, I see you're unmuted. Were you going to jump in there?
I was just thinking, there is a part, especially when it first happened, of feeling shrunken and sort of held in and isolated.
Yeah. Shrunken, held in, isolated. I love this. Zoe, how about you?
I was going to say I had an experience recently and it made me feel anxious because it was at a work situation and I made a slight mistake. And just in an interactive type way, and I felt, you know, really caught off guard, and it was unsettling, you know, because I didn't realize it at the time. And so trying to go back and understand, you know, where I had gone wrong was very unsettling and anxiety producing.
I totally understand that. So isn't this interesting? If we compare the language that we offered around righteousness had a rigidity, a strength, solid, all the different words and anything that you might notice as a sensation or your experience about it, and then as opposed to wrong, embarrassment, shame, unsettled. But to Deborah's point, there's an opportunity to say, oh, I missed that. I want to fix that. I'm going to go back. So this is a very important piece around how we hold fixed views and how pride and ego and cultural conditioning around attaching good with right and bad with wrong. But when we're constructed in righteousness, in fixed views, that's often not a place of learning. That's often not a place where the mind is expansive, where the heart is available. And it also might be the fear of being wrong. It actually goes into the central nervous system because it may be perceiving danger. Right? The perception of possible threat or danger can come around with being wrong. Oh my God, what did I do? So there is a physiological component that is happening with how one holds views, rightness, wrongness, righteousness, however you want to put it. But I think it's very important to now circle this back to this teaching from the verses of the faith mind that it doesn't have to be either one. It doesn't have to be either one, that we are in a continual practice of learning, of being human. It's hard to be a person. We live in a culture that glorifies individualism and mastery. What if we don't have to do that? What if we really take into our hearts and our practices the practice of truly showing up, truly showing up? Joanna Macy talks a lot about that, about you don't have to be hopeful or hopeless. That's not what it is. But just show up. Just show up. So when we're given permission to show up as we are, to show up and not know, the practices and teachings around beginner's mind, bearing witness, taking the next caring action, what happens is I think it takes us into this space of no preferences, of openness, of curiosity, that gives us the ability to say to somebody else, what is important to you? And we don't have to evaluate whether they are right or they are wrong, even though there's a propensity for that because it's kind of how our minds work, especially in a fearful time, especially when the stakes are very high. And we know the stakes are very high. But the more I think we can come back to our common humanity, the better chance we have of connecting in a real way and decreasing harm that can be caused. And especially when we each take that on as a commitment to not do that. And I think that, you know, when I brought in our meditation, asking you, inviting you to sweep through the heart with the breath cycle, the Brahmaviharas, breathing in metta, breathing it out, the same with compassion and mudita and equanimity, is a beautiful way that Bhikkhu Anālayo talks about practicing with the Brahmaviharas. And Bhikkhu Anālayo, the wonderful contemporary Theravadan monk, he says that with metta, the heart loves. With compassion, the heart responds. With mudita, the heart delights. And with equanimity, the heart allows. Isn't that a beautiful framework?
Would you say that again?
Sure, sure. Let me give you this. I'll put this in the chat also. I am happy to share these notes. Okay, so there you go. So the remedy to the propensity and the conditioning around rightness and wrongness, and I think the way one can get to this place of no preferences, of making space for many things, is through the Brahmaviharas, through cultivating the wish for others to be well, through metta practice, through compassion practice, that the heart can respond skillfully to heartache, to suffering, to difficulty. And mudita, the importance of mudita, to delight in somebody else's delight, to me, that is freedom. It's not about me, then. And I think mudita might be the hardest of these, because we really have to get out of our own way in order to truly feel the happiness, that some feel happy for somebody else's joy. It's not about me. It's really about them. And I think that is actually a doorway to metta, to karuna. And out of that, the heart allows, has more and more capacity, practices of equanimity. It's a beautiful piece from Rumi. So often in our practice, especially in Zen practice, the moon and moonlight are akin to awakening. So here's a beautiful short poem from Rumi. Moonlight floods the whole sky from horizon to horizon. How much it can fill your room depends on its windows. Right? It's all out there. And are we available to it? Sometimes yes, sometimes no. Right? We have different amounts of bandwidth. But our practice is opening and opening and opening. Moonlight floods the whole sky from horizon to horizon. How much it can fill your room depends on its windows.
Thank you.
So that is what I wanted to talk with you about tonight. How do we talk with each other and say, what is important to you? What is meaningful to you? How do we open up the heart mind to not hold so tightly to views and opinions in order to get to that question? So what would you like to comment on, talk about, offer your reflections? Barbara, please. You are not unmuted yet. It won't work. Okay. Well, if you figure it out, come back. Zoe, how about you?
Okay, I'm going to fumble this a little bit, just words, with words, but I think I understand what you're talking about, what you're pointing to. And the questions that come up are, what's the difference between view and truth?
Yeah, isn't
because
it?
there are some truths that I think are large truths in the world about kindness and how we should treat others. And if we see, for instance, a world figure or a national figure that's talking continuously about harming, and the view comes up for us that is not okay, and that sends me into a state of fear and upset and whatnot, is it wrong to have a view that it's wrong when someone else is harming?
I don't think so, you know?
Is that self-righteous, or is that just protective, and is that the natural human reaction that one would hope for, to stand up against something that's harmful or someone that's harmful in a big way? And so I don't know. I think you can still apply this practice, and it, you know, you can still do the practice to relieve some of your own personal suffering and be able to approach those people who maybe have that aren't as hardened around the concepts, that maybe share different views about it. But there are some individuals in the world who are so set about harming others that I don't know how you come to a meeting with those people and how you open your heart to that. And I just don't see where that's view. I think there's something that's deeper, that's like truth, or something that's bigger.
Yeah, I love that you're saying this. And this is why we wrestle with this. This is why this is a grapple. And so what I'm hoping to bring in here is a conversation that allows us to say exactly what you're saying. And I do think that when the Buddha says, by not holding to fixed views, so the fixed part is the crux, I think. And I'm with you. You know, when there is anybody who is intent on harm, for self-aggrandizement, for whatever purpose, there is truth. And our ethical practices guide us. And I think what each one of us has is can be the commitment to say, I'm not doing that. That is harmful. That doesn't work for me. I'm not participating in that. And it also takes us into a deeper place, which is that I think it opens up the window to see how much suffering is happening in the person who is causing harm.
Yeah.
That opens up to the compassion of, oh, this person is not well. This person is really suffering and doing a lot of damage.
Mm-hmm.
That is also true. But many things can be true at the same time. But the way I relate to it is, I have to make sure that I don't fall into the trap of causing harm. I have to make sure that I can act in a way that is kind, might be strongly, but that it doesn't hurt others. Because the more of us who take on a commitment to non-harming, the more non-harming will happen.
Mm-hmm.
I just think this is an enormous conversation that needs to be had at this time when things are so difficult and that the
right.
stakes are so high. So I really welcome your views, your heart. You know, we don't need to be afraid of opinion, the word opinion and view, but I do think it's important to keep in mind, where are the places in us that might be limiting our capacity to have a bigger view?
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Of course. Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Barbara.
Actually, my topic was similar to Zoe's. The whole idea of when you're in the presence of a great moral wrong, and what I'm thinking right now is Emmett Till,
mm-hmm.
something that is just so horrific,
Yeah.
And the feeling, the bodily physical feeling is different from simply being huffy and solid and righteous. There's something, it's almost like you break open and sort of, and I can't articulate the whole thing, but it's like there is anger, but it's not about me at this point. It's about
That's right.
the world. It's about everything. And it's anyway, I'm just wrestling with that because it's important not to get stuck back into that righteousness, but at the same time to acknowledge what is happening.
And this, I think, is the path of the Bodhisattva. The Bodhisattva who says the world is suffering, it's my job to meet it because of how deeply disturbing the suffering is. Emmett Till. I mean, we could go on and on about horrific acts of violence that have caused enormous damage. And when it hurts us so badly, we first make the commitment not to do it, not to cause harm, and to work towards the good in the way that meets each one of us, in the way that works for you. This is all such a big conversation, isn't it? And the Dharma gives us a way to talk about it, I think. Deborah, please. You are muted.
Can't find a way to raise the yellow hand on my Zoom thing.
That's okay.
This is going to be really clumsy. The only thing that I can think of, and I love, thank you so much, Zoe, for bringing that up, because I was having those thoughts. It's like when I'm watching an animal show, you know, about, you know, the jungle somewhere in another part of the planet, and the leopard or the lioness is going out to hunt to feed her cubs. And then she comes along and kills somebody else's baby to feed her cubs, the little gazellette, or, you know, and I'm appalled that this little baby gazelle is, you know, being attacked and murdered. And I'm feeling for the gazelle's mother. But I also know that this big cat is feeding her babies. And it's like, how can I hold that? It's like juggling balls or plates or something in the air. How can I? So when somebody's like a virus in our culture, you know, if it's, again, very clumsy here, but if somebody is doing great harm and they're like a virus, I don't want to be hateful. I just want to be eradicating.
And so then you choose how to do that, right? That isn't hateful, that doesn't cause more harm. Voting is one way.
Eradicating is the right word, because that sounds kind of violent, but you got my point, so thank you.
Totally got your point. This is not easy. This is, and I think this is important that we're talking about it. Who else? Mary, please.
So there was a TED talk a while ago. And it was by a young woman who was raised in that church in Texas, the one that was just doing horrific protests and stuff like that. I forget the name of them, but they were just doing, so talk about harm, horrible stuff, terrible things. And she was raised in this church. So there was, they had like, you know, talk about fixed views. They had really fixed views. And according to my views, it was, they were very unskillful and led to a lot of harm. And she gave a TED talk, and it was because this person had a conversation with her, and I think it was started in the media, and they listened to what she had to say, and it was, and there was no ill will on this person's part, and little by little, this conversation that she was having with this person enabled her to have the conversation. And what you said earlier really struck me, is that you're not holding to your fixed view. It's you're talking about what is important to you.
Right.
And really, that's where their conversation went. And it wasn't about other stuff. And it really allowed her to see that they had a place where they could meet.
Yep, that's right.
And it really got her to see is what's important to me is my view gelling with that. Anyway, it was just, to me, I thought this is really important. If you have, is to find something that you can have an open heart with your common ground. And that's a really big, I think is a really big difference between I'm this party, I'm that party, I'm this or that, like what is important. And I think that that is a place to have, start your conversation. If you're going to have a conversation with somebody and what's important, you may find what they consider important is not the same. I mean, I have family,
but that doesn't matter, right?
It doesn't matter. You listen to them anyway.
That's right.
And you listen to, and you really listen to them. And I think that that is the big thing. And it's like not to hold that with ill will. I mean, sometimes I can think, oh my gosh, you got so deluded.
Yeah. I mean, you might think that, but it isn't the point of the conversation.
No, it isn't.
If when mindfulness is alive and in its full expression, it includes this non-judgmental curiosity that is courageous to sit with someone who may not be the person you would normally sit with and say, tell me what is important to you. And I want to tell you what is important to me. I know we don't need to change each other's minds, but this is about coming together about what is meaningful. One, each person's expression of their own life and what is important, because what comes out of that is the vulnerability that says, this is who I am, this is who you are. And when vulnerabilities meet, I think an instinctive kindness arises.
Yes, yes.
And that is my point here, is can we say what is important to each other? We're not going to be the same as each other, and we don't need each other to be the same. But we do need a way to see our common humanity, because that is what I think will, if I use the expression, save us, but offer a tremendous amount of healing.
I agree. And I really like that you brought that up as a point, because I really believe that is so true and so helpful in my conversations with others. Thank you.
Yeah. Just to say, what do you love? What is important to you? What is a meaningful part of your day? I mean, what if we just asked each other that? Tell me about your day. What is something really meaningful that happens for you each day, or something that you've put into your life? Then we're sharing who we are. And when we know who each other is, when we can share that, we're much more likely to care about each other, because we probably find something in common. Yes, Deborah.
Again, maybe not skillful. You just said non-judgmental curiosity, and I wrote that down, and I thought, when I'm listening to certain people in my life, a cousin here or a friend there, and I want to know what they're thinking or why they did this or why they do that, or, you know, is there some way I can help them in, with a health thing or something, I don't know that I'm not judgmental. I don't know if I'm ever going to be that enlightened or that purified.
It's an intention. It's just
I could just leave myself out of it, like you were saying.
That's right.
Yeah, I can just listen to them, really wanting to know and care and be there for them. And like you're saying, I guess I don't have to change them, and I'm not probably going to be changed. But
who wants to be changed, right? I think what we actually want from each other is my hunch, is to be accompanied, right? Is to be accompanied, and this is what we are doing. We are accompanying each other. We console, we celebrate, we connect, all of these things. But mostly we really don't want others to attempt to change us or convince us of anything. We want to be heard and respected. Thank you, Deborah. Nancy.
You know, this is a very extreme example, but I've been having a conversation with myself as you've been bringing this up of, let's say there was someone like Hitler, and I have pondered this before in my mind. I cannot imagine not having ill will towards someone who had done some massive harm and how I would handle that. Now, like I said, that's extreme, but I have some similar difficulties watered down, but with Trump.
Yeah.
And I, it's just something I ponder is how in the world does one do that? And especially if harm had been done to someone whom I love and care about, I just don't know if I could ever do it. I can't imagine being able to do that.
So we start small. Yeah, I don't know if I could either. I mean, let's just say that. I don't know. I don't know. And that's the truth. I don't know. But just like with metta practice, you know, the fundamental instructions are when we start working with ourselves, we work with people that are easy to love. We work with friends. We work with people we don't know very well. And ultimately, we start sending metta to those who we have difficulty with. But we don't start there because it's too hard. So it's a training of the heart, bit by bit, to open and open and to feel the reactivity go down. But you have to do subtraction and addition before you do calculus. So start smaller. Does that make sense, Nancy?
Yeah, that's a great answer. Thank you.
Okay, you're welcome. Okay, Barbara, and then we're going to end.
I've had maybe the luck or the horrible problem. I've had communication with some very violent, evil people, who would be called evil. And what I've found is that the delusion sometimes is very, very deep. And they can be very, oh, I love little foxes. And yet I want to go out. We don't. I mean, it's very scary because they themselves are not coherent beings. It's like being with a world full of really destructive energies, and sort of to be able to have that faith that, oh, well, we're going to sit down together and say what's important. Sometimes we just have to recognize that that person might not be capable.
I think that's absolutely right. But we need to start where we can start, and not with the idea that we're going to fix all of this. But we really, this is a training of our own hearts, our own capacity, and we do this bit by bit by bit.
And yeah, idea that it's a training for, to make it, take it back to ourselves, that curiosity, and not fix the other person.
That's right.
Some people, Hitler, they're not, generally maybe in another lifetime or 5,000.
But that is why in the Bodhisattva vow, we take this up as a long-term intention. This is not something that we're going to come to Sangha one night and say, okay, I got it. No. We need each other to do this, to remind ourselves of our goodness, to start exactly where we are and just take the next step. Right? You know, the Buddha who said, his penultimate teaching, strive on with diligence, move into the future with confidence, take the next good step, the next helpful step. That's what's necessary.
And there's always a gulamala.
That's right. There's always Angulimala. That's right.
Stop. It can happen. Redemption is always possible.
People are redeemable. So let's not throw everybody out just because they once did something awful.
Right. But
to but have our eyes open. Let's have our eyes open.
Recognize the kind of suffering that is there is, again, that sense almost of awe of how horrible suffering can be, how much someone can suffer.
Yeah. And we make the commitment not to make it worse.
Right.